the psychophysiological principle. The relationship between mind and body is remarkably intricate and bidirectional, a concept formalized in the psychophysiological principle. Consider public speaking. Just imagining giving a presentation can make your hands clammy and your heart race. Conversely, taking slow, deep breaths can calm your anxious thoughts. This mind-body connection operates continuously, often below our conscious awareness. The principle, formally articulated by Green, and Walters in 1970, states that every mental or emotional change triggers corresponding physiological changes, and vice versa. This isn't just theoretical, we can measure these connections. For instance, researchers have found that Botox injections, which prevent facial muscle movement, actually reduce the intensity of emotional experiences. This suggests that our ability to frown or smile influences how strongly we feel emotions. The clinical implications are profound. Understanding this principle helps explain why techniques like biofeedback can be so effective. By learning to control physiological processes such as heart rate and muscle tension, we can influence our emotional state. Similarly, psychological interventions such as mindfulness meditation can lead to measurable changes in physical parameters, including blood pressure and immune function. This principle also explains why stress management is crucial for physical health. Chronic psychological stress isn't just in your head. It creates real physiological changes that can affect everything from wound healing to cardiovascular health. Conversely, physical practices such as yoga or progressive muscle relaxation can have a profound impact on mental well-being. The autonomic nervous system. The autonomic nervous system, ANS, is a sophisticated control network that maintains our internal balance without conscious effort. Unlike the voluntary nervous system that controls skeletal muscles, the ANS operates automatically, regulating crucial functions like heart rate, digestion, respiration, and body temperature. The ANS consists of three major divisions: sympathetic, parasympathetic, and enteric. Each division has distinct anatomical features and uses different neurotransmitters, chemical messengers. The sympathetic and parasympathetic divisions often work in opposition, like a car's accelerator and brake, while the enteric division manages digestive functions semi-independently. The ANS connects with virtually every organ in the body through two neuron chains. The first neuron originates in the central nervous system, brain, or spinal cord, and connects to a cluster of nerve cells called a ganglion. The second neuron extends from the ganglion to the target organ. This arrangement allows for both precise local control and coordinated system-wide responses. The higher brain centers, particularly the hypothalamus, provide overall coordination of autonomic function. The hypothalamus integrates information from throughout the body and initiates appropriate autonomic responses. This control is further modified by the cerebral cortex, involved in conscious thought, and the limbic system, involved in emotion, allowing our autonomic responses to be influenced by both cognitive and emotional factors. The sympathetic division. The sympathetic nervous system, SNS, is an intricate network that prepares our body for action and challenge. Unlike the quick on-off switch many imagine, it's more like a sophisticated emergency response system with multiple levels of activation. When triggered, the SNS initiates what we commonly call the fight or flight response, but this term oversimplifies its complexity. The system operates through a fascinating chain of nerve cells that runs parallel to your spine, from the thoracic to lumbar regions. These nerve pathways use a two-neuron relay system. Preganglionic neurons emerging from the spinal cord connect with postganglionic neurons in the sympathetic chain ganglia. This arrangement allows for both precise targeting and broad coordination of responses. What makes the SNS particularly interesting is its ability to create both localized and system-wide effects. Through a process called divergence, a single preganglionic neuron can influence multiple ganglia, allowing for coordinated responses across several organ systems. Conversely, through convergence, multiple preganglionic neurons can influence a single ganglion, ensuring robust response when needed. The SNS uses different neurotransmitters at different points in its pathway. Preganglionic neurons release acetylcholine, while most postganglionic neurons release norepinephrine. This chemical diversity allows for nuanced control of different target organs. The system also has a unique relationship with the adrenal medulla, which acts like a postganglionic neuron but releases hormones directly into the bloodstream, creating longer-lasting, body-wide effects. The parasympathetic division. The parasympathetic nervous system, PNS, is far more sophisticated than its common designation as the rest and digest system suggests. This division of the autonomic nervous system originates in two distinct regions: the brainstem, through cranial nerves, and the sacral spinal cord. The vagus, the 10th cranial nerve, is particularly crucial, serving as the primary parasympathetic pathway to most internal organs. Unlike the sympathetic system's chain-like arrangement, parasympathetic ganglia are located very close to or within the organs they control. This anatomical arrangement allows for precise, targeted control of individual organs. Both preganglionic and postganglionic parasympathetic neurons use acetylcholine as their neurotransmitter, but they act on different types of receptors, allowing for nuanced responses. The PNS plays a vital role in energy conservation and restoration, but it's much more than just an off switch for stress responses. Recent research has revealed its crucial role in inflammation control through what's called the cholinergic anti-inflammatory pathway. Through the vagus, the PNS can detect and respond to inflammation throughout the body, helping to maintain immune system balance. Most fascinating is the PNS's role in social engagement and emotional regulation, as described by Porges' polyvagal theory. The myelinated vagal fibers, evolved more recently in mammals, enable us to self-regulate our emotional states and engage in complex social behaviors. This explains why techniques like controlled breathing can have such powerful effects on emotional state and social behavior. Porges' polyvagal theory. Stephen Porges revolutionized our understanding of the autonomic nervous system with his polyvagal theory, which reveals a sophisticated hierarchy of neural circuits that evolved to help us respond to environmental challenges. The theory gets its name from the multiple, poly, branches of the vagus, each serving different evolutionary purposes. At the heart of this theory is the understanding that our nervous system continuously evaluates environmental safety or danger, a process Porges calls neuroception. Think of it as a personal surveillance system that works without our conscious awareness. This system evolved in three distinct stages, each adding a new layer of adaptive responses. The newest and most sophisticated part of this system is the myelinated vagus, which evolved with mammals. When we feel safe, this pathway enables what Porges calls the social engagement system. It helps us regulate our facial expressions, voice tone, and hearing sensitivity, all crucial for meaningful social interaction. This is why we can't easily engage in friendly conversation when we're feeling threatened. Our biology literally shifts away from social engagement under stress. The sympathetic nervous system represents the next evolutionary layer, enabling the familiar fight or flight responses. But perhaps most fascinating is the oldest circuit, the unmyelinated vagus. This primitive pathway can trigger immobilization, also known as freezing, when we face overwhelming threats. This explains why some people become paralyzed with fear in traumatic situations. It's not a choice, but rather an ancient survival mechanism at work. The enteric division. The enteric nervous system, ENS, often referred to as our second brain, is far more complex and sophisticated than many realize. This intricate network contains about 100 million neurons, roughly the same number as in the spinal cord, and can operate largely independently of the central nervous system. It's not just about controlling digestion. It's also about processing information, learning, and remembering. What makes the ENS particularly fascinating is its neurochemical complexity. It produces and responds to virtually every neurotransmitter found in the brain, including about 90% of the body's serotonin and 50% of its dopamine. This chemical sophistication explains why emotional states so profoundly affect digestive function and vice versa. The gut-brain connection is very real and bidirectional. The ENS is organized into two main plexuses: the myenteric plexus, which primarily controls muscle movement, and the submucosal plexus, which regulates secretion and blood flow. These networks communicate constantly with both the sympathetic and parasympathetic divisions, creating a complex web of interaction that responds to both physical and emotional stimuli. Recent research has revealed that the ENS plays crucial roles beyond digestion, including immune function and even emotional processing. The vagus serves as a major communication highway between the ENS and the brain, carrying information in both directions. This helps explain why stress can upset digestion and why certain gut conditions can affect mood and cognitive function. The relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic branches. The interaction between the sympathetic and parasympathetic branches is far more nuanced than the simple gas pedal and brake analogy might suggest. Traditional views presented these systems as operating on a simple continuum, where one system's activation meant the other's inhibition. However, research by Berntsen and colleagues revealed that these systems can operate in at least four different patterns. Think about playing a musical instrument. Sometimes you need both hands working together, other times in opposition, and sometimes one hand might work while the other remains still. Similarly, the autonomic branches can work antagonistically, in opposition, complementarily, producing similar effects, cooperatively, different effects that achieve a single goal, or independently. Let's explore antagonistic actions first. When you're startled by a loud noise, your sympathetic nervous system may increase your heart rate, while your parasympathetic nervous system tries to slow it down. This competition, called accentuated antagonism, helps fine-tune your response to challenges. But consider sexual function as an example of cooperative action. The parasympathetic system promotes arousal, while the sympathetic system controls climax. Neither system alone could orchestrate this complex response. Some organs receive exclusive control from one branch. For instance, most blood vessels and sweat glands only receive sympathetic innervation. This exclusive control allows for precise regulation of specific functions without potential interference from the other branch. Homeostasis and autonomic balance. Homeostasis, first conceptualized by Claude Bernard and later termed by Walter Cannon, represents the body's remarkable ability to maintain internal stability despite external changes. Think of it like a sophisticated thermostat that doesn't just control temperature, but manages dozens of variables simultaneously, from blood pressure to pH levels. Modern understanding has evolved beyond the simple idea of fixed set points to recognize that many physiological variables operate within acceptable ranges rather than exact values. This concept, called the boundary model, better explains why normal values can vary between individuals and situations while still maintaining healthy function. The concept of autonomic balance, developed by Wenger, suggests that individuals tend to show characteristic patterns of autonomic control, ranging from sympathetic to parasympathetic dominance. These patterns, measured through ABAR scores, can influence susceptibility to various disorders. However, the healthiest pattern appears to be one where neither branch consistently dominates the other. Psychophysiological measurements. Understanding how we measure psychophysiological responses is crucial for both research and clinical practice. Think of these measurements as taking snapshots of the body's activity at different times and under different conditions. We categorize these measurements into three main types: tonic, phasic, and spontaneous activity. Tonic activity represents our baseline physiological state. Imagine it as the idle speed of your car's engine. When researchers measure tonic activity, they're examining the baseline level of physiological functions over time, typically during a quiet, resting period. For example, your resting heart rate or baseline skin temperature would be considered tonic measurements. These measurements are particularly valuable because they reveal a person's typical physiological state before any specific stimulation or intervention. Phasic activity, in contrast, represents the body's specific responses to defined stimuli, such as how your car's engine revs when you press the accelerator. When someone is startled by a loud noise, the sudden spike in heart rate or skin conductance would be a phasic response. These responses are generally quick and tied to specific events, making them useful for understanding how people react to particular stimuli or situations. Spontaneous responses present an interesting challenge in psychophysiology. These are physiological changes that occur without any apparent external trigger, like your car's engine occasionally changing speed even when you haven't touched the pedals. These responses can complicate research because they might be mistaken for responses to experimental stimuli. For instance, If someone's skin conductance naturally increases when they're shown an emotional image, researchers need to be careful not to attribute that entire change solely to the image itself. Orienting and defensive responses. Our nervous system has evolved two distinct ways of responding to novel stimuli: the orienting response and the defensive response. Understanding these responses helps us appreciate how our body prepares to deal with potential challenges in our environment. The orienting response, first described by Pavlov, is like your body's way of saying, "What's that?" It's a sophisticated pattern of physiological changes that help us gather information about new stimuli. When you hear an unusual sound, your head turns toward it, your muscles tense slightly, your heart rate actually slows down, and your breathing becomes deeper and slower. This response is designed to help you better perceive and understand potential threats or opportunities in your environment. The defensive response, on the other hand, is your body's way of protecting itself from intense or threatening stimuli. Unlike the information-gathering orienting response, the defensive response involves withdrawal. Heart rate increases, blood vessels constrict, and sensory sensitivity actually decreases. Think of it as your body's way of putting up shields when it perceives potential danger. What's particularly interesting is how these responses habituate or become less intense with repeated exposure at different rates. The orienting response habituates quickly because once we've gathered information about a novel stimulus, we no longer need to continue investigating it. The defensive response, however, habituates much more slowly, presumably because it's better to maintain protective responses longer when dealing with potentially threatening stimuli. Activation and habituation. The concept of activation, first developed by Elizabeth Duffy, represents a fundamental way our bodies prepare for action. Think of activation as turning up the volume on your body's responses. As activation increases, you may notice your heart beating faster, your breathing becoming more rapid, and your muscles tensing. However, the relationship between activation and performance isn't as simple as more is better. Duffy discovered that performance typically follows an inverted U-shaped curve. Imagine trying to thread a needle. If you're too relaxed, you might be clumsy, but if you're too anxious, your hands might shake. There's an optimal middle ground where your activation level helps rather than hinders your performance. What's particularly interesting is that this optimal level varies depending on the task. For a weightlifter, high activation might be beneficial, but for a surgeon performing delicate procedures, lower activation levels would be more appropriate. However, later research by John Lacey revealed that activation isn't as straightforward as initially thought. He showed that our bodies don't just turn up all systems uniformly. Instead, different physiological systems might respond in distinct ways to the same stimulus. For example, when solving a complex math problem, your heart rate might decrease to help you focus, while your muscle tension increases, a pattern Lacey called directional fractionation. Habituation represents the flip side of activation. It's how our bodies learn to stop responding to stimuli that prove to be irrelevant or harmless. Imagine moving to a house near train tracks. At first, each passing train might startle you, but over time, your body learns that this stimulus doesn't require a response. This learning process helps conserve energy and maintain focus on truly important environmental changes. Situational specificity. Understanding situational specificity helps us appreciate why our bodies might react differently to similar stressors in different contexts. This concept explains why someone might have perfect blood pressure readings at home, but show elevated readings in a doctor's office, known as the white coat syndrome. The fascinating aspect of situational specificity is how our bodies learn to associate particular physiological responses with specific environmental cues. These associations can be remarkably precise, involving multiple elements like location, time of day, present company, and even subtle environmental factors. For instance, a person might experience anxiety symptoms only during morning meetings with their supervisor, but feel completely calm in afternoon meetings with the same person. Law of initial values. The law of initial values, LIV, proposed by Joseph Wilder, introduces a crucial principle about how our bodies respond to stimulation. Think about stretching a rubber band. If it's already stretched quite far, you can't stretch it much further. Similarly, Our physiological systems respond differently depending on their starting state. This principle helps explain why the same stressor might produce different physiological responses at different times. For example, if someone's heart is already beating rapidly at 100 beats per minute, it's less likely to increase substantially further in response to stress compared to when it's beating at a resting 60 beats per minute. This isn't just true for heart rate. It applies to various physiological measures, though not uniformly. Interestingly, some measures, such as skin conductance, don't follow this pattern as strictly, indicating that our body's response systems have different operating principles. What makes this particularly relevant for clinicians and researchers is its practical implications. When studying stress responses or implementing biofeedback training, we need to consider these baseline values. A high initial value might make it harder to achieve further increases, while a low initial value might make it easier to observe changes. This understanding helps set realistic expectations for both treatment and research outcomes. Generalization of biofeedback training. The way biofeedback training transfers or fails to transfer across different body systems and situations reveals fascinating insights into how our bodies function. One particularly interesting concept is the key muscle hypothesis, which was once widely accepted but has since been disproven through careful research. The key muscle hypothesis suggested that training one muscle to relax, often the frontalis muscle in the forehead, would lead to general relaxation throughout the body. It's an appealing idea, like finding a master switch for tension, but research has shown our musculoskeletal system operates with much more specificity. Adjacent muscles can be in completely different states of tension, and reducing tension in one area doesn't automatically affect others. Similarly, temperature training and biofeedback shows remarkable specificity. When someone learns to warm their right hand through biofeedback, this ability doesn't automatically transfer to their left hand or feet. It's like learning to wiggle your ears. Mastering control of one side doesn't automatically give you control of the other. This specificity has important implications for how we approach biofeedback training, suggesting that we need to specifically target the areas we want to influence rather than expecting widespread effects from limited training. The placebo effect. The placebo effect represents one of the most intriguing phenomena in medicine and psychophysiology. Far from being just imagination, placebos can trigger real, measurable changes in the body. Think of it as your body's remarkable ability to heal itself when it expects healing to occur. What's particularly fascinating is that these effects aren't limited to subjective experiences, such as pain relief. They can also produce measurable physiological changes, ranging from immune system responses to alterations in brain activity. The power of placebos extends far beyond what many people realize. Research has shown that placebo responses can match or even exceed the effectiveness of actual medications in some cases, with response rates often reaching 60% or higher. Even more surprisingly, these effects can persist for extended periods, sometimes as long as the effects of actual medications. What's particularly intriguing is that placebos can work even when people know they're receiving a placebo, a phenomenon called the open-label placebo effect. The mechanisms behind placebo effects are complex and multifaceted. When someone receives a placebo treatment, several processes can occur simultaneously. The brain can release its own natural painkillers, endorphins, or mood-enhancing chemicals, like dopamine, in response to the expectation of benefit. Modern brain imaging studies have revealed that placebos can activate many of the same neural pathways as actual medications. For instance, when people receive a placebo they believe is a pain reliever, their brains show increased activity in areas associated with pain control. The implications for clinical practice are profound. Far from being a nuisance to control for in research, the placebo effect represents a powerful therapeutic tool. Understanding how expectancy and conditioning influence treatment outcomes helps clinicians maximize therapeutic benefits. For instance, the way a treatment is presented, the therapeutic environment, and the practitioner's communication style can all enhance treatment effectiveness through placebo-related mechanisms. Perhaps most remarkably, research has shown that placebo effects appear to be getting stronger over time, particularly in conditions like depression, where the placebo response has increased by approximately 7% per decade. This suggests that our growing understanding of mind-body connections and increased acceptance of their importance might actually be enhancing the power of these effects. This understanding of the placebo effect brings us full circle to our earlier discussions of the psychophysiological principle, providing a perfect example of how mental states and expectations can create real, measurable changes in bodily function. It reminds us that the mind and body are not separate systems, but deeply interconnected aspects of a single, complex whole.